Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined by Michael Medved, who, look, we're radio guys. You've been doing radio for a long time. I used to do radio, so we have a lot to talk about, Michael. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Well, what a pleasure, and absolutely delighted to see this new effort doing so well.
Well, thank you. I want to, you know, dive into the news of the day, but before we do this, as you well know, I reviewed your most recent book, The American Miracle, for Commentary Magazine, and I've been wanting to ask you this question because, of course, this book makes the argument that America has somehow been protected by divine providence, that for whatever reason, God has been cutting us a lot of slack. So I guess the question will be, looking around in 2019 with everything that's going on, Michael, are we still... I mean, you know, are we still in favor? Are the higher powers still looking out for us, or are we kind of on our own now?
Okay, let me back up for just a moment before I answer that question. Yeah. And I don't mean to be doing this in a politician style, but it really is necessary. I don't make the case that America is especially uniquely deserving of divine favor. I make the case that we have clearly been used as an instrument of divine will. And this, by the way, was the emphatic belief of Lincoln. It was the belief of Adams and Jefferson, and also, to an extraordinary extent, to Franklin Roosevelt. And it's been a consistent belief of all the most significant American leaders, which is that America has a role to play in the world. We're just not another country. It's not just a question of, well, are we going to make really great trade deals and beat China or beat this country or beat that country. It's that America has a role to play in the world, which is going to be undeniably positive. And one of the things that that my book makes the case for, and I'm right now finishing the second volume in the series, which is called God's Hand on America, is that even when Americans don't seem to particularly deserve divine favor, we've experienced it, but not for reasons of reward, but for reasons of implementing some grander plan. And if you look at the course that humanity has taken, Jonah Goldberg makes this point, and I think he's entirely right, that if you look at all of human history, it's an unspeakable mess. I mean, it's nasty, lives are nasty, brutish, and short. It's a really horrendous situation in terms of the levels of suffering and oppression and massacres and misery. Steven Pinker has now done a couple of books about how the world has improved and these dramatic leaps of progress. Almost all of it is associated with the United States. Mm-hmm. And you can go back. It's from the founding of the discovery of the New World and the founding of the initial colonies. A lot of people don't know this. At the time of the American Revolution, the American colonists enjoyed the highest standard of living in the world, which is one of the reasons that the British on their side were so ticked off. Here these people are complaining about a few pennies in taxes, and they are living better, eating better, earning more, doing better than the people back home. And we were. In any event, the question about whether we are still enjoying divine favor, we're going through a rough time, but compared to the rest of the world, it's honestly not so bad. And the role that America plays in the world as a protective, redemptive, positive influence, I don't see any other nation or even collection of nations that's ready to step into that breach. I know that President Trump would like the European Union to step into that breach. He's kind of indicated, and America to step out of it. But there's no substitute. Mm-hmm. And the question would be, if not America as the leader for the cause of decency and sanity in the world, who would play that role?
And there used to be a consensus about that, I think. So my question is, this: you're articulating, of course, the view of American exceptionalism, but is there an expiration date for that exceptionalism? As you point out, there's nobody else out there who will be able to step up, you know, for the protective, redemptive, positive role that we have played. Does that mean that I mean, is the lack of an alternative mean that we will never lose that that designation?
I don't know. Never is a long time, and I sort of, to paraphrase the James Bond title, I'll never say never again. And the one point that I think back on, Charlie, is when I was a kid, I worked on Robert Kennedy's presidential campaign, and I was there at the Ambassador Hotel when Senator Kennedy was shot, and it was the biggest event of my adolescence. I mean, really, really was, because I had taken a leave of absence from Yale, and I was there and campaigning in Oregon and then in California for the primary. In any event, that right at Robert Kennedy's funeral, which was at St. Patrick's Cathedral, John Updike, the great American novelist, made a comment, I now believe that God has removed his special blessing from America. And you know what? People have always said that. I mean, I've gone back for my new book and looked in history. When did people start saying, okay, we once had a special blessing, now we don't anymore? And actually, it's William Bradford, the governor of Plymouth Plantation, in the 1640s, who was the first one to say that. And it's been said in every generation that we no longer desire God's protection, no longer deserve God's blessing. Let me remind people that since the Kennedy assassination, we had the whole Morning in America experience. We won the Cold War. We have made enormous progress on our racial issues in this country. And that, by the way, is one of the undeniable truths that every American should be forced to acknowledge. And when I say forced to acknowledge, I don't mean by government, right, but I mean by people like you and me, reminding people of the amazing things that our country has achieved and accomplished even in the last 20, 30 frustrating years.
Now, this is a very interesting point because, you know, you're mentioning 1968. And by the way, 1968 always felt like, you know, the center of my adolescence as well, because I was actually working on the Eugene McCarthy campaign in 1968. And I remember all of this very vividly. But, you know, the 60s were succeeded by the 70s, Watergate, Vietnam. And however awful things seem right now, there was a real sense that things were falling apart. And it would have been very difficult to have imagined in 1974, for example, the Morning in America, or the fall of the Berlin Wall, or the rise of the modern economy. So those perspectives, I think, are very, very valuable. But there's something useful, isn't there, among the people who are at least asking the question, you know, has the favor of heaven expired? Have we done something have lost that favor? That there is always that tension, acknowledging the special role you play, but also stepping back and saying, but you know, it is not an entitlement, and maybe some of our good fortune might be more fragile than we might want it to be?
I think that's absolutely accurate, and of course it's a legitimate question, it's an appropriate question. It goes back to Lincoln, and I'm one of those people, if I wore wristbands, I would wear a wristband that said WWALD, what would Abraham Lincoln do? Because I think Lincoln should be, and you know this from reading my book, I mean, should be our ultimate guide. By the way, in the way we live our lives, too, the way we interact with people. Lincoln was famously asked, and this is at the beginning of the war, well, Mr. President, do you recognize that God is on our side, do you not? He said, I don't know that, he says, but I sincerely hope that we should be on his side. And that's I think the real question for Americans: are we doing what we're supposed to do? And again, Otto von Bismarck, who was a very clever guy, though he doesn't get a lot of good PR in America, the Iron Chancellor of Germany and Prussia, Bismarck once said, "It is the role of the statesman to listen for God's footsteps in history, and then when he hears them, to grab his coattails and hang on." And that is it seems to me, what our leaders should be doing right now. Go ahead.
I wonder whether this perspective is what makes watching what's happening now seems so painful, that if you have a sense of the role of America, if you have a sense of the significance or of the statesmen who have come before us, watching the clown show that we have right now, I think probably maybe that's why it cuts deeper. And that it, but if you don't have that sense, if you don't have the sense of this of the sweep of history, if you don't have a sense of who once built this country and the people like Abraham Lincoln who inspired us, if you don't have that sense, then you know maybe this reality TV show is not so bad because you don't really know anything. Because I have found myself going back and reading more history and thinking more about the American idea in the last several years than I did before. And I think it's to remind myself that this is the, you know, that perhaps we deserve better than what we have right now.
Oh, without question. And by the way, I've had exactly the same experience, Charlie. And it's fascinating that you were talking about working in the Eugene McCarthy campaign, because I do think 1968 has particular relevance to us right now. And don't you remember the same sense in 1968 when it looked like the choice was going to be between Lyndon Johnson, who was a miserable human being, mm-hmm. and I think a leader of deep, deep corruption and problems associated with him, and Richard Nixon, who at the time, and Nixon is such a complicated and conflicted figure, but nobody would say that he was a tower of moral probity. I mean, these were two very compromised guys. And there was a sense of despair that led initially to that Dumb Johnson movement in the fall mm-hmm. of 1967, and then to the Eugene McCarthy campaign. And by the way, most people don't know this. It wasn't the New Hampshire primary that changed the world. It was the Wisconsin primary, where I guess you were working, right?
I was. In fact, my father and I were the ones who opened up the McCarthy campaign in November of 1967 in one hotel room in the Wisconsin Hotel in downtown Milwaukee. But of course, you do remember that Lyndon Johnson dropped out of the race the Sunday before the Wisconsin primary because he knew he was going to lose.
Exactly. He did that, and he lost by, it was like 60-40, wasn't it, in Wisconsin? Against a sitting president?
He only won 2 of the 10 congressional districts. So it was a very strong repudiation. Yeah.
Yeah, yes, and that so, was why, and it was because of that, and of course, Wisconsin being right next door to Minnesota, where Eugene McCarthy was from, Eugene McCarthy being a Catholic and a fairly serious Catholic, and appealing to Catholic sentiment in your state, it was an amazing, and by the way, you know that Senator McCarthy went on to endorse Ronald Reagan for president in 1980.
Yeah, we've all gone on very strange paths, haven't we? What I also remember about Eugene McCarthy was that he was a poet of some talent. And you know, now that we have people whose skills amount to being able to tweet, there's been some loss there.
There's no doubt. One of the things, and it still gives me chills to think about it, was I had already joined the Kennedy campaign at the time that Dr. King was killed. And when Senator Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, spoke in Indianapolis to an all-black crowd, basically, the night, and it was in the rain, it was the night that King had been killed on April 4th, he quoted Aeschylus by memory.
And, those elitists.
I know.
Those elitist globalists.
Hard to be imagined either President Trump or, say, Nancy Pelosi.
I just would like them to know history, just the broad outlines of history, just a little bit. I mean, I feel like I've lowered the standards over time to think of history. Listen, in the time that we have, I wanted to ask you a couple of other things. We could get into some of the issues of the day, but I'm finding this more interesting. How long have you been on radio?
22 years.
Okay, I was on in Wisconsin.
Since before you were born, right?
23. I was on for 23 years. The transformation of the conservative media has really been something, you know, that I experienced, you have experienced. And I gave an interview the other day, and I said, one of the things that's really happened is, and this is obviously not true of every single show, because it's hard to generalize, certainly not the work that you've done and other people that we both know have done, but that that in the beginning, I really thought that we were a forum for really interesting, the interesting exchange of ideas. But increasingly, the conservative media has become a safe space for a lot of people on the right, which, of course, is ironic since conservatives will often accuse the left of being snowflakes and wanting to have safe spaces. But I think that one of the things that's been happening is that we much of the conservative media, there's been the pressure to become the alternative reality silo, to protect people from inconvenient facts, to confirm their biases. And I've sensed less tolerance for dissenting ideas or for ambiguity than you would have hoped for from a medium that I think you and I probably both thought at one time was going to be the new town hall where Americans would come and reason together.
Yes, and I think we functioned in that capacity years ago, and many of us did. I know you did, where not all the people who were listening to the Charlie Sykes show were dyed-in-the-wool pro-life conservatives. Mm-hmm. There were people all over the map, and that was part of what made your show interesting and alive. And I agree, of course, with every word you've just said. Mm-hmm. I agreed with most of the arguments, mm-hmm. nearly all of the arguments, frankly, you advanced in your mm-hmm. book. I think this is a very, very tough time for conservatives because too many of us, particularly in the conservative media sphere, are more concerned with doing right, meaning doing right wing, than with doing right, if you will, capital R, and doing the things that are actually going to help our country and help our cause. And if you look at the most recent example, I couldn't believe it. We had this really embarrassing back and forth between two giants in history, Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi, mm-hmm. over whether he was going to deliver the State of the Union address mm-hmm. in the House chambers. And finally, President Trump did the obvious right thing and the thing that made him look good, and it was one of the, I think, a very, very good move by President Trump, which is saying, okay, we'll postpone the State of the Union. There's nothing in the Constitution that says it must be delivered on January 29th. We'll postpone the State of the Union, settle the damn stupid, moronic, pointless, mm-hmm. pathetic shutdown, put that away, and then we can come together with an atmosphere perhaps of celebration and comedy and bipartisanship, and then I'll deliver a really great State of the Union address, he said. Now, the point that I'm getting to, this has been slammed on talk radio.
Yeah.
I mean, people have called him a wuss, a sellout. This is not the Trump we voted for. Honest to goodness, really? You want him to go to the border, as people have suggested, and deliver a State of the Union in front of an unfinished wall?
Ann Coulter does, probably.
I know. Well, Laura Ingraham does very.
I mean, the government is shut down because of folks like that. I mean, isn't the government shut down because of Ann Coulter, Rush Limbaugh, and Laura Ingraham, who keep beating the drums?
Don't forget Sean Hannity. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. No. All of them. The problem is it's. I don't know, and then if you dissent from any of it, any of the stupidity, you're supposed to go to re-education camps.
Yeah, no.
And one of the reasons that I have stuck with the medium is sheer cussedness, mm-hmm. and basically not wanting this dichotomy, this Manichaean distinction that. They, and by they, I mean the corporate managers and individual voices, they all seem to want to impose, which is that you're either on our side or you're on the other side.
Exactly.
And it's sort of like you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. And for goodness sake, I think that most Americans today, the overwhelming majority, really do identify with what Arthur Schlesinger defined back in that 1968 year that you and I were talking about as the vital center.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that there are good things on both sides, there are stupid things, God knows, on both sides, but the right course for America is to take from both sides and to move forward in the national interest rather than dealing with this as if, only the Patriots or the Rams that can win.
Well, the loudest voices are not coming from that center. Now, since you said some nice things before, I, 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 I want to stress to people, and this is not to play the victim card, but I don't think it is possible to overstate the pressures on a nationally syndicated talk show host like you, Michael Medved, or on local conservative talk show hosts to toe the line to get on the Trump train. The business pressures, the audience pressures, the political pressures, the draw of tribalism is so intense that I understand why so many other conservatives who had no illusions about Donald Trump and might have, you know, spoken eloquently against what he represented, but have decided to trim their sails or to, you know, perform these dramatic pirouettes. But it's also how rare and how much moral courage it has taken for folks. And I've said this about my former colleagues at the Weekly Standard, people like Stephen Hayes, who needs to get a shout out for standing athwart all of those pressures. And for someone like you, I had a conversation, by the way, Michael, where somebody was saying, saying how difficult it was to be, in the conservative media in this particular moment. And I was trying to come up with the number of names of people who had stood against it. And outside of you and a couple of local hosts, I couldn't get to five. I'm missing correct. Somebody. I know you don't want to pat yourself on the back, but the moral courage, you described it as sheer cussedness. I described when I wasn't going to go along with it is simply because I'm all out of bleeps to give. Maybe it is the fact that we're at a certain age and it's like, what the heck? I'm not going to.
Right.
But we've seen people that we've known for 20 or 30 years who have demeaned themselves in so many ways, who are going on the air and saying things that I'm not sure that they can actually believe, but they may not feel they have a choice.
I think that's unfortunately true. And look, in my case, and again, this is not, as you said, to play the victim card or a bid for sympathy or anything like that, but a lot of this has to do with my own journey. And as you know, at the end of 2014, I was diagnosed with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, I had throat cancer, which, of course, is perfect when you make your living talking in public. And I have been inordinately blessed beyond measure with my family and my wife's support and the support of our children and now grandchildren. And I'm fine. I'm cancer-free.
That's such good news.
It's wonderful news beyond measure. I was cancer-free. Mm-hmm. By the end of 2015, and basically, it was very difficult for me. I had to give up my show for 11 mm-hmm. weeks, and that was actually the first glimmer of basically, I think what was going to be a very real problem, because I was arguing from my hospital room with my syndicator about who was going to guest host my show in my absence. And the idea that when I was sick, I would not be able to choose my mm-hmm. own guest host because I would choose someone who, like me, was not towing the party line. And at that time, this is before the rise of Trump, the key issue was immigration. I am a Reagan conservative. I'm a Bush conservative. I believe that immigration is a positive for our country. And no, I don't believe that we are going to successfully deport 11 million people. And okay, so
I remember those discussions.
oh, yeah, I'm sure you do. You were on the air.
Right.
And what you were saying, I think you said something very profound, Charlie, and this was the experience with me, is the worst thing was not working with colleagues or business associates. It was the listeners. Because I would get, particularly in the middle of the Trump campaign in 2016, I'd get these anguished emails, and I think they were legit, from people who said, I prayed for you when you were sick. I prayed for you when you were off the air for your cancer. And now I wish I hadn't because you're so negative to President Trump, and President Trump is the only one who can save America. And how can you not see that? And then people writing in and saying the cancer must have destroyed your brain. How can you be doing? And there's a natural tendency for all of us, if we have people who have been admiring and loyal and really care about you in the way that people do, because it's a real relationship that you build up.
It is a real relationship. I mean, you have a you're in people's heads for decades. These are people that you have been having a conversation with, right?
Well, it's not just that. As you and I know, and I know you have the same thing, there are certain people who you come to know. You've never met them, but it's for instance, Edna in Butler, Pennsylvania, who used to call the show all the time. It's Tom in Glendora, California. Tom still calls the show, thank God. But when those folks basically are saying, "I'm done with you, I'm never listening again,"
this was the story of my 2016. Yeah.
Yeah, but it leads to, I think, some useful perspective, self-examination, and which I guess it's healthy at our stage in life also. And if I can come back once again, and I don't want this to be like old guys looking back on the glory days of our youth, but I do think that this coming election in 2020 is not going to unfold in a conventional manner. And I don't think that there are going to be more options, I think, for people, because our democracy demands it, our country demands it, and ultimately I think Providence demands it. I cannot imagine that we won't get a much better choice somewhere, somehow, than we got in 2016, which was...
I certainly... From your lips to God's ear, that's all I can say.
Yeah. No, again, I'm just speaking again from a personal perspective. The choice between Hillary and Donald Trump was like the choice between a heart attack and cancer. It was not an inspiring choice.
Yeah,
sorry.
Do you want to drink arsenic or be fed through the wood chipper? You know, choose.
Well, I guess arsenic, you have a chance of survival.
I suppose. No, the story you're telling about those those relationships, I can really identify with it, because it was a sad thing, and also it was a little shocking that people who had trusted, you know, me for 20 years would say this was the hill they were going to die on, and they were done with you because of this one thing, and it was Donald Trump of all of those things. But I think maybe, you know, I assume that you would have made this decision, you know, had you not gone through your medical crisis. But I always, you know, when I think through these things, one of the books that influenced me so, you know, so much in my life was, you know, Viktor Frankl's The Meaning of Life, where he, you know, asks you to imagine, you know, you're on your deathbed, you're 90 years old, and you're looking back on your life and looking on the choices you make and the way those choices really shaped what the meaning of your life was. And I always think of it that way, and I just cannot imagine ever saying, yes, getting on board this particular populist, nativist, absurdist train, that this would be something that I would look back on later in my life and say, yeah, I'm really glad I made that choice, because that meant what? That we owned the libs. And, you know,
Well, let me tell you, I haven't made this public before, and I probably my producer, if he was about to make it public, said, don't say that, because it'll get out and it'll look bad. Okay, here goes. I just to show how much in line we are, Charlie. I was surprised when a friend of mine, who is in conservative media, who also has severe doubts about President Trump, but is one of those people who's made peace with it. He was able to, there was a White House Hanukkah party where the chosen ones among the Jewish community were invited to the White House Hanukkah party to celebrate Hanukkah with Donald and Melania and Jared and Ivanka. And as somebody who's been very prominent and active in the Jewish community, I've been a synagogue president, I've been on the board of a lot of Jewish organizations. Okay, so an invitation came, and it's kind of fun. I've been to 3 White House Hanukkah parties in the past with President Bush, which were lovely occasions. And so I was thinking about it, and I talked to my son about it. And my son is a father, thank God, of 2 adorable little girls, 1 2 years old and 1 3 months old. And basically, what we came to was this, was that if I go to the Hanukkah party in Washington, D.C., they're going to end up with pictures with me, with President Trump and Melania, big smiles, and that's what happens at these occasions. And as Danny said, you know, I don't want sometime 50 years from now, my daughters seeing their pictures of their grandfather in this situation. And, okay, so I didn't go. And, you know, boo-hoo, right? But it did make for that reflection. How do I want those grandchildren to remember me and look back upon my career and what it's meant? I don't want to end my career in squalor.
I do think there are a lot of people who will look back later and will think of, you know, the decisions they made, you know, to be close to power, to be close to celebrity, to get that dopamine rush of being in the court. And they will, I think, too late realize that it was not worth it. Michael Medved, thank you so much for spending time with me today. I appreciate it very, very much.
What a joy, and I hope we can speak again, because there obviously is so much to share here. And I'm thinking of Auden's verse. Now, here we were talking about Kennedy quoting Aeschylus, but in his poem, September 1st, 1939, he talks about those lights by which the just exchange their messages. It's part of where Bush got the idea, Peggy Noonan writing for Bush, of the 1,000 points of light. Well, keep the light flowing and growing.
Thank you so much. And thank you for listening to the Daily Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will try to keep those lights on, and we'll do it all over again.